Welcome to episode 28 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. All of Your Business is a proud recipient of a 2020 X-Ray FM Podcast Award. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM. You can also find them at xray.fm. On this episode, we're speaking with Deborah Porta, Executive Director of Pride Northwest. And now your host, Michael Jonas.
Yeah, so I was on that call with you yesterday where we were talking to PABA, or ORCID is their new name. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you were from Texas, so I kind of wanted to learn more about that. That's an odd way to start, but I just kind of want to know, like, how you ended up in Portland.
Well, I am originally from Dallas, Texas. I grew up in the Metroplex. I grew up in Dallas and lived in the Metroplex area until 1997. I moved to Portland. July will be 24 years, I think. Yeah. And really, I moved up here to do something different. I had a really good friend who was moving up here, and it just happened to be good timing. I had a career in Dallas in restaurant management, but I didn't really have much of a life. It was probably I'm not an impetuous kind of person really. But it was probably the most impetuous thing I've ever done.
How old were you?
I was 30 years old.
Okay.
When I moved here.
And so did you tell your family, like, hey, I'm leaving Portland? It doesn't sound like it was a conversation. It was just like, I'm leaving.
Well, yeah. I mean, I definitely didn't have to ask anybody's permission.
Yeah.
I told my parents that, my mom, my stepdad, that it's been so long now that I'm sure we had conversations that started with, I'm thinking about doing this. Because I do look to my mom for guidance. You know, she's a super smart woman. So I'm sure we had some ongoing conversations about what is moving look like, kind of a thing. Mom's very pragmatic and sensible. So, you know, did I have a job? Did I have somewhere to stay? Was I leaving with any, did I have any money in my pocket? Any of those things? So we kind of worked through those pieces but it was really like, okay, I'm going to do this thing. And then we just worked through what it looks like. I moved up here with everything I own in the back of the pickup truck that I owned at the time.
Were you out when you were in Texas?
No.
Or did you come out later?
I came out after I'd been up here for probably about a year, year and a half. I came out to my mom. In a letter. It wasn't even over the phone. But when I was in Texas, I definitely didn't feel comfortable being out. So really what I did was just work. I just didn't have a life. It wasn't about hiding or any of those things. I just didn't have a life. So it was sort of a non-issue about having to, whether I was out or not. I just didn't. So until after I was up here for a little bit.
And, you were here. Did you start doing restaurant management, or what did you start doing?
I pretty much had a job waiting for me when I moved up here because I worked for a quick service restaurant in Texas, the corporate, the parent company. And so I pretty much did the interviewing and had a job waiting for me with a franchise up here of the same company.
Very cool.
No, I'm not that impetuous. I'm like, I'm going to need to know I'm going to be able to support myself. So.
Yeah. So you're here for a little bit, or year, year and a half, 2 years. And you realize that you probably knew you were gay before actually were coming out. What did that look like for you? I know that Portland was a very different Portland at the time.
It wasn't. I'm not one of those people that has I don't have a super exciting coming out story. Really, it was meeting somebody and going on a date, really, and just you're right. I knew before I moved here that I was definitely lesbian. but again, I just didn't live life. And so really what changed moving up here was probably some unconscious freedom that came along and being in a different place and knowing that I at least was very unlikely to be fired if I was, in Dallas, it's just one of the reasons I didn't participate in community, because that was, you could go to Pride and if you ended up on some news camera, you were going to lose everything. And although Portland was definitely different almost 25 years ago than it is now, it was still further along than what Dallas was. So, the comfort just kind of came over time. And so really I just, met somebody and dated for a while. And then, I was out.
How did you get involved with Pride activities, Northwest Pride, being an advocate for,
Sure.
Gay life. I mean, you could have been quiet or just lived your life, but you decided to be a social advocate and a volunteer.
Well, basically, when I was 36 years old, I went back to school and went back to college. I was, restaurant world and customer service world, those are not actually physically easy jobs. And I could no longer do them. I had too many injuries and all kinds of stuff. So I went back to school to learn a new trade, basically. And, over time, I learned that it doesn't really matter how old you are when you go to college, that world exploding thing happens and your world opens up and you learn all these new things and including about yourself. There's confidence that hopefully comes with that learning and meeting new people and being in new environments and all that. And it evidently doesn't matter how old you are. It's still an impactful experience. So really, I think what happened was when I went back to school, I just kind of started growing up, really, and kind of becoming more of myself as opposed to this very sort of shut down workaholic that I had been before. And it just kind of went from there. While I was at Portland Community College, which is where I started when I went back to school, I got involved in student government. I got involved with the queer club on campus. I met somebody and had a torrid affair on campus. And we all, she was a volunteer for Pride Northwest. And so she yanked me in that year. And that was 2006. And then as it happens, she goes on her way and we're done, but Pride stuck. And so I was invited to join the board of directors because as it is with small organizations, I showed up and somebody gave me a title. and And within a few months, I was board president because most of the board left. And, you know, I don't really know exactly why Pride stuck the way that it did for me, because that was definitely my launching point. I think it's all connected to what I said earlier about, as I, you know, when I went back to school and as I was growing, becoming more of myself, and, you know, it just kind of went from there.
And you were still volunteer for quite some time, right?
Like, oh yeah. I was board president from 2007 to November of 2015. And then still volunteered and advised and took care of sponsorship before becoming our first executive director part-time near the end of 2016, and then full-time near the end of 2017.
And I mean, I know more than most, but not in the sense of putting on an event and facilitating various community contacts. I don't know if people really understand the nature of this endeavor. There's so many pieces, there's so many moving parts. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Like, how do you even begin? How do you conceptualize? Are you a really organized person? Do you make lists?
Life would be so much easier if I was that organized. A lot of it has been trial and error. I've definitely made mistakes over the last 15 years. But Portland Pride, you know, I can't talk about Pride everywhere necessarily, but, you know, Portland Pride has grown, I think, much more quickly and much more significantly than I think even the community was aware for a while. It was not uncommon, and it'll still happen sometimes, for, you know, someone to contact me in March and asking, you know, like, well, are you getting ready to plan Pride? Let's do this. And we've been doing it since last July. You know, it's a year-round process at this point, particularly because our Pride Northwest itself is active year-round. But even just the event on its own it's a destination Pride now. People come from all over. We have people who travel from international locations to come to Portland Pride. And you know, I mean, it's a large endeavor, and I, fortunately, where I'm really fortunate is I am fairly good at having people around me who are not exactly like me, which means that, 'cause I am not, my strength is in relationships and making connections. I am not going to be the person that's going to make the best list of what needs to happen and when it needs to happen. So someone's going to work with me who's really good at that and really good at those details, and then we do it together. So that's, yeah. It's,
yeah, that's, I get that. You know, I'm not the best at making spreadsheets and things like that. And
right.
But there are people who love it. They're like, I could make every spreadsheet. I could make every list.
Oh yeah.
So I know that, you know, there was COVID, right? There still is COVID. There was a certain kind of Pride last year, and then there's a certain kind of Pride this year. Which I'm really excited about, because we're actually going to have some things that are live and some things that sort of feel more like Pride. But can you kind of talk about first, like, COVID hits, the world shuts down, you know, where are you in the planning process and what did you do?
Well, that was mid-March last year. And in Pride time, we like to, it's sort of the running joke is that, you know, March is about half an hour from the event. It's, we have at the point in which COVID reared its head, we had already almost completed all of registration for both the festival and the parade. We were full because we had opened beginning of March. And, you know, that's what's indicative of how much we've grown is registration. We'd open in late February, early March, and it would take until May, not anymore, 2 weeks, and we're full. It's done. So we had already, you know, we were in the final, you know, sort of planning stages of executing the event. And when, you know, we're fortunate that we work with really connected professional event people who, those are the professional folks that help us with the festival primarily. And so they're very connected to the event world, and which means that we also have the ear of what's happening. So we had some indication of what was coming before it really started breaking out into the public. I was talking to other event organizers around the country, talking to the Rose Festival folks locally. The professional people that we work with also manage and run the Blues Festival. So these conversations were ongoing for a while. And when it became really clear that that things were just not going to be able to happen, we had to make that decision. The point at which we knew that we had to make the decision was before, and this is very practical. We were about to have to start writing the big checks for, you know, permits and all these things. That all those things were in place, but it was about to be time to start paying for them. And to risk that kind of revenue, that kind of funding, on something that was so risky and very likely not to happen, we just weren't going to take that chance, not with our community's money, because that's where our money comes from. It's our community's dollars that we put back in, and we just weren't going to risk losing that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it looked like, you know, my boyfriend and I attended virtual Pride, and it was fun, you know, but, how did that come about? I mean, was it a choice of we completely scrap everything or we do something virtual?
We didn't really ever seriously contemplate scrapping everything, because, you know, our biggest concern with the possibility of having to cancel Pride, so to speak, and particularly the festival and the parade, was really this question of what does it look like for our community to all of a sudden not have its visibility and connection. That was a big concern of ours, because Pride is so important in that way. So we knew before even making the final decision that one way or the other we were going to do something. So as soon as we made the decision to have to cancel the actual parade and festival, we just immediately pivoted, which is everybody's favorite hated word now, into preparing something virtual. And the process that we followed was based on, okay, what do we have? What can we do? What do we have available to us? What's our capacity? Because we're a small team. And then what's happening around us, because COVID's happening, Black Lives Matter, you know, blew up basically. It just, all of that was happening all at the same time. And so we looked at what we could do and then basically geared our programming to be responsive to all of that happening.
Yeah. And I think it's great that, you know, you said the overused word pivot, but you know, you pivoted well in the moment in what was needed and what was possible. So I thought that was great. And then what about this year? I mean, it's not the same parade festival type thing, but I'm already realizing you have all sorts of things planned.
Sure.
So talk a little bit about those.
Sure. Well, you know, at the end of last year's Pride, we knew that it was highly unlikely that 2021 was just going to boof right back to traditional. There's just no way that things happen that quickly. And so from the get-go, we have been planning around what we knew we could make happen, no matter what the restrictions happen to be. Again, we're fortunate to work with really professional event folks who have their ear to the ground on all of this. And so that's what we've done, so that we wouldn't have to worry about and deal with planning something and then having to cancel and change and all these different things. So from the very beginning, we have been planning for what we know we can do. I'm actually pretty excited about we have a more robust plan this year, a schedule of events than even I anticipated having. What started as an idea around a couple of drive-in movie nights, because those all of a sudden the drive-in made a return with COVID, right? Because you could stay in your car, has turned into a full-day mini film festival in partnership with the directors of QDoc. And that's a new relationship for us. This is part of what's happened with COVID is, and this is in no way negates, because the negative impact of COVID overshadows anything positive coming out of COVID. But it has forced everybody to get a little bit creative about what we're doing. And it, for us, you know, when you have an event as large as the Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, it's really difficult to change it. If you want to do something a little different, you can do little pieces and this and that, but it has a community expectation now. And it's really difficult to do just wholesale change of what we're going to do for Pride. And COVID kind of basically provided a window of, well, you know what, we kind of get to start from scratch a little bit and get creative about what does it mean to celebrate Pride? What does it mean to have Pride? What does Pride look like? And I know that you and I have talked about this some, you know, a large part of where our time and effort in the last 14 months has gone is to, you know, direct community support and really on the ground advocacy and direct lifting up of community, because our people were hit really hard. And that has allowed us to get back to where Pride came from to begin with. It was Pride, the event of Pride is a starting point. It's not the end point. And so really what all of this last 14 months has allowed to happen is the opportunity to take a breath and slow down a minute and really think about, what does our community need and want from Pride? And the hard part of that is that's different for everybody. There's no such thing as a universal opinion from our community about anything. It's true. We're all different. Yeah. Our identity on the spectrum is the thing that ties us together. Everything else about us is as diverse as every other, you know, as society itself. So that's kind of how we've approached this year, and this is how we're looking at next year as well. When we are able to come back together in significant numbers, hopefully, what does it look like?
So, yeah, that's definitely true. And, for some, and rightfully so, Pride is, you know, drinking and dancing and that sort of thing. But there's also
the, I don't know who you're talking about, Michael. I don't
there's also, you know, the educational component, the generational change or shift. Like, you know, in years past, when pre-COVID, Pride didn't look like it did even when I was younger. I mean, I see more families, I see more intersectionality. So I guess, and then there's the love, there's the being seen and being heard. But I guess one thing I'm wondering from you, which is something I think a lot about, is like this educational component, having people not forget all that was to get here, right? So
yeah,
I'm kind of wondering, I mean, that might flow through with the film festival, that might come from storytelling. How do you suggest that, you know, we sort of maintain those stories or that history so that it's not forgotten, so that a young out person today here's a story about someone who is, you know, now 75, who couldn't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, or had to their whole entire life sort of remain in the closet, or learning about the AIDS crisis, or learning about Stonewall. What's the best, and there may not be a right answer, but I guess my question is like, well, what are some of the ways that I or you or people listening can make sure that those histories remain alive and that education remains?
Well, I mean, I think there's, I think you're right that there's no one answer. I can, you know, I can speak for Pride Northwest in what we're doing. You know, first and foremost, even just recognizing that so much of our history has been lost. Because we didn't expect to have a history. We didn't, you know, we're this, it's an interesting thing because we are missing almost an entire generation of people because of the AIDS crisis, the AIDS epidemic, excuse me. And so there's so much of our history and what people have experienced that didn't get passed down and didn't even get experienced because we lost so many people. And, you know, I've thought about this before. The LGBTQ plus community, our people, you know, there's a lot of stigma still attached to us. And we have been, forget the word, but, you know, inculcated, culturized, there's a word for it, I forget. You know, for example, our generations don't get to hang out together because we're not related to each other. So if you have a gay teenager, for example, a young boy and a gay man hanging out together, there must be something wrong. Something's not right because they're not family, although that mentor relationship could actually be what's happening. So we have internalized as a community our own stigma around generations don't hang out together because the larger society said it's wrong for gay people to hang out together. Because if we do, it's obviously because we're going to be doing something nefarious, right? So we have generation after generation that don't have those ties with each other. We don't, you know, the family unit, so to speak, its primary purpose is to create and prepare the next generation, right? That's how we as a species continue. But in the case of the LGBTQ plus community, we don't physically birth our next generation for the most part. Right. So we have to find that connection. We have to actually physically make it happen because it's not built into our culture. And on top of that, when you have people who are marginalized, victimized, erased, all of those things, and then you add on the epidemic and these pieces, we don't plan to have a future anyway. So it reminds me a little bit of the generation that really grew up during, especially the early part of the Cold War, when every day could be the last day because someone's going to drop an A-bomb somewhere, right? I remember talking to older folks, especially back in Texas, about what that was like. You didn't plan a future because you just didn't expect to have one. You didn't expect anything to be there. And I see, I think part of where we're at now as a community is a result of that, because we don't have those bonds as strong as they could be to tie us together in like really strong levels of mutual support. And that future thinking piece that comes with, like, it makes a difference in how you make decisions today if you're thinking about the impact that'll happen three generations from now. But we don't do that because that's not how we have been, you know, that's not how we've developed as a community, because we haven't been allowed to.
Sure. And it sounds like now, you know, we have to appreciate life and take each day, but there is a future.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess figuring that out, you know, we're paving that as we go.
Oh yeah.
One thing that I've noticed about Portland, and I know that it's changed over time, is that, and this sounds really odd, but like gay people are integrated, you know, like even when I was in San Diego, there's Hillcrest, there's like a gay area. And even though, you know, Portland, we have gay bars, we have a gay area. But it also just seems like gay people are our neighbors and our community. There's not like, this is the gay area. I mean, even in San Francisco, some people think the whole city is gay, but then we have Castro and,
right.
So I just think that's interesting that in Portland and surrounding areas, it seems now as if people who are gay or have gay families are part of the entire city. It's not relegated to, you know, this is the hill that you live on, or this is the street where you're at.
In a lot of ways, definitely. Portland is, I think, somewhat unique in that we don't have that, quote, neighborhood. You know, in a lot of ways, that's a positive thing because we're less, you know, there are less issues, depending on how you define less. And, you know, we that's part of what lends itself to the fact that we have a lot more rights in Oregon and Portland and et cetera, right? At the same time, I'd see two things. We have more rights than most any other place in the country, but we've still had to fight for that. It's not like it just naturally happened. And it could still be taken away. So that part of things hasn't changed, even though the state itself, the region that we live in, is more open to making those kinds of changes. The other thing I think that happens in, you know, there are a lot of people in our community who are, you know, integrated into the larger society, which also means that if you're not integrated or you're not the person who can be integrated, you're still excluded. You're still ostracized. And, you know, part of that acclimation and assimilation means giving up some of the uniqueness of who you are in order to achieve that, right? Which kind of leaves us still in the same place. That's where, you know, pride, the history of pride has a lot of mythology around it. Pride was not born at Stonewall. Pride did not start as a protest, and people are going to hate me for that, I know. But it's true. Stonewall was a riot. Pride was not a riot. Pride was being planned, or excuse me, marches and parades, they've been called either one of those from the beginning, were being planned prior to Stonewall. Stonewall became a convenient launching point to really engage the community in real action. That's the role that Stonewall, and there's no, that doesn't minimize Stonewall. I think that actually makes Stonewall even more important than the so-called birth of Pride, because the impact is much larger. You know, I'm more interested in the work that came after Stonewall than I am about who threw the first brick. But we, you know, that entire part of the movement came out of the people who were, even within our ostracized community, were still ostracized further out. You know, these were not the tie-wearing, suit-wearing, dress-wearing, middle-class, mainly white folks. These was everybody else. And, you know, there's a risk in prioritizing assimilation and integration, because there are still rules for who's allowed to do that and what does that mean, what's proper for being assimilated. And if you don't meet those rules, then you're not. So we haven't actually progressed very far in that particular sense of things, because the same people who were marginalized, oppressed, ostracized, pick a word, at the time of Stonewall in 50s and 60s are still the same people who are excluded, ostracized, and pushed out.
Sure. And yeah. And that, you know, that makes me think a lot about Marsha Johnson, and then, we're still today talking about trans rights and trans laws. Mm-hmm. And that's something I wanted to ask you about, what your thought was on this sort of, I don't know if it's a rush or popularity of, you know, telling trans people what they can do or not do based on the binary gender norms that exist, whether it be sports, whether it be going to the bathroom. There's sort of like a big revival of that right now. And I don't know. I mean, they'll tell you it's not about hate. You know, they'll tell you that it's because their kid, you know, they're worried about their son or daughter making the team, and they think that a trans person's going to take their spot. But so I guess, what is your thought on all of these sort of exclusionary rules and laws, and why are we here again?
Well, I mean, we've never not been here. I think, you know, this is one of the, I don't know if danger is the right word, but this is one of the potential dangers of being in a place like Oregon, specifically being in a place like Portland, where we're not as comfortable as we think we are, but we're comfortable enough to be comfortable. And you start, you know, there's a certain amount of apathy that comes with that. There's a certain amount of privilege of, I am not in immediate danger right now, therefore I don't need to react to something, that comes with not, you know, not having your life on the line in your face at the moment, right? And so I remember years ago, not long after I moved to Portland, there were these conversations around, you know, how do we as a community get away from always being on the defensive? And we're always going to be on the defensive, because as soon as there's a certain amount of comfort reached, particularly for a significant portion of our community, the vigilance goes away. The awareness and the connection of realizing, okay, I might not be in deathly danger at this exact moment, but my community is. You know, it is that classic of, when I've reached a certain point and I don't need to worry about anybody else. And we're kind of bad about that.
Well, I think we've learned the last 4 years that rights that have been given can easily be taken away.
I hope we've learned that. I'm not so sure. It's cycles. I think as soon as we have a fairly comfortable period, we'll forget. That's the entire premise of our country is it's not like we're ever actually going to arrive in a place where we don't need to be aware and vigilant of stuff. That's our entire country is based on recognizing that we got to fight for what we need and what we want. And our community is no different.
What's your view on what we need to do for intersectionality? I mean, that's a big conversation now. So, you know, someone might be Black and gay. And so I know you had a great question last night from an African-American woman about how Black Lives Matter or just, you know, Juneteenth or any, like how that relates to Pride and how, you know, not only are the people celebrating Pride not monolithic, but then there are people who have various cultures. So someone might be Latino or identify as Latinx, but they're also identifying as queer, or someone may be Black and queer. I guess, how does Pride Northwest work on making sure that intersectionality is addressed? So that it just doesn't become like a white corporate Target Pride, even though I love Target, you know, that sort of thing. Like, how are we making sure that everybody is sort of under the umbrella?
Well, you know, it's, I wish I had a clear, direct answer. I can speak to what we're doing and what we prioritize. You know, that conversation last night definitely has stuck with me. I'm hoping to be able to connect with her. You know, when I first became involved with Pride Northwest, when I became board president specifically, one of the very first things I did was, because the biggest question that was put to me constantly was, why are there so many prides? Why can't you all be together? Why is, you know, and although I could guesstimate what that answer was, I'm like, if the Latino, now Latinx community pride, if that event exists, and it did at the time, there's a reason why that event exists. And so I took my role as to be, let's go find out and form these relationships and find out how Pride Northwest can support whatever it is they're doing. And so that's the approach that we have used, at least in my time with Pride Northwest. You know, that question came up last night about, you know, why can't we integrate and all be together? And my answer is the same. We, Pride Northwest, will do what our community, specifically like the Latinx community, the Black community, because at the time there was Latino Pride and Black Pride. Our actions will fall from whatever it is they need from us. And if that means supporting a separate event, then that's what we're going to do. We're going to support a separate event. If that means integrating together, that's what we're going to do, is we're going to integrate together. But those choices need to be led by the people being impacted. Because even though I may know on the back end that Pride Northwest is a pretty small organization, we are considered to be the large pride, right? Because we're the largest pride in the area. And there's a significant amount of privilege that comes with that, definitely. But there's the perception of power that also comes with that. And so it would be hugely inappropriate in my mind to walk into a Latinx Pride planning meeting and start talking to them about integrating with, quote unquote, Portland Pride. Especially if I didn't know what they were hoping to do. What are their goals? you know?
Yeah, that's a good, I mean, that's a good point, because I think that's one of the biggest problems is people prescribing to another person or group what we think they want or need, but that may not be the very thing that they want or need.
Right. Well, exactly. You know, the big argument that you hear is, you know, well, we're stronger together, and why do we have to be divided? And, you know, over and over, the answer that I get and the answer that you're going to get from, you know, the Black queer community, for example. And again, all of this sounds like we're talking about monolithic groups, and not everyone's the same, but just in general, you know, in my conversations with the Black Pride organizers at the time, because it's been a while since there's been an organized Black Pride or Latinx Pride, is we were already separated. We were already divided because we weren't included to begin with. So the premise of why do we have to be divided is, in all blunt honesty, a very white perspective.
Sure.
You know, so that's just, you know, we have taken the stance that we're going to be responsive to what those parts of our community need from us. And in the meantime, we're going to support them in whatever it is they want to do. That's why we fiscally sponsor smaller organizations. That's, you know, there are a lot of things that we do based on what's asked of us from those from those parts of our community, because we're going to follow their lead. We're not going to tell them what they need to do. It's the same thing. And, you know, we haven't talked a whole lot about this. Last year, when Black Lives Matter, you know, really blew up and George Floyd was killed and everything happened, there was a fairly significant push on us to organize a Pride March in support of Black Lives Matter. And we that didn't feel right, because the Black community wasn't asking us to do that.
Sure.
And, you know, down in, I think it was it LA? LA Pride jumped on that bandwagon and started planning a Pride. And there, the Black community down there and the communities of color tore them up, because they started planning this big queer response without ever actually even talking to the black community, queer or otherwise, about whether or not that's actually how they needed Pride to show up.
So even if there were good intentions, it was that it appeared as if they were co-opting, you know, a movement. But also, like what you're saying is, if you don't even have that conversation to assess if this is something you want, you know, we shouldn't be assuming like this is what they need or this is what they want.
Right. That's why it's so important to, you know, to have these relationships. And believe me, we can still strengthen our relationships. But that's why it's so important to have relationships across these lines, so that you, so that you have a sense of what's happening. But also so that when something does happen, you're going to be able to connect and say, what do you need from us? How do you need us to show up right now? So that we can then follow that lead. Because if you don't have those relationships, you're not going to know. And that's when you start assuming and, you know, fall on your face.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I want to talk to you about is you do work besides... Sometimes it's Pride related, sometimes it's not Pride related, but I really admire your community work. And I know that you help with feeding people through programs. You also had the sock drive. Can you kind of just talk to me a little bit about that, but also kind of just the general, how can people incorporate community or mutual aid in their everyday? What would be some guiding principles or advice for that?
Well, it's my, that's a good question. Honestly, I think the answer is kind of the same as what we were just talking about. If someone is not connected to, in contact with, communication with, and educating themselves about, for example, what it means to be housed, to be unhoused, and how all of the different reasons why someone gets in that place and all of the things that it means about their lives, then you're not going to know how to tie in and how to support. So a lot of it has to do with kind of that same approach of if you want to know what to do, ask the people that you are attempting to ally. Ask the people that you're thinking about supporting. What do they, how do they need for you to show up? What kind of support do they need? If they don't need socks, don't raise a whole bunch of socks. In this case, socks are like a huge need. You know, don't show up in any way to support another group of people unless you've talked to them about how they need for you to show up. What do they need from you? If you know, bringing 10 cases of tomato sauce is not what they need, right? They need for you to write a check because they could go and buy 20 cases. Well, then just write them a check. You don't need to show up with 10 cases of cans that they could have gotten for twice as much.
Sure.
Those are just really small examples. But it's just really, it's that human connection, you know, kind of like what we were talking about a little bit earlier, where, you know, we're in different places in our lives and we have different roads that have brought us to wherever it is we happen to be, but we're all people and we're all part of the same society. And, you know, that commonality, I think, is the important piece. It doesn't mean that we all have to be the same. It doesn't mean that we have to assimilate. It doesn't mean any of those things. Because no matter how we present and no matter how our lives play out, we're still all people. Like, that part doesn't change. Everybody needs food. Everybody needs some kind of shelter. Everybody needs some kind of, self-determination. You know, there's a lot about our social service network, web that is hugely disempowering for people. That's why it's so difficult a lot of times to, you know, that's why you have folks who drop out of the system, who become, you know, like the chronic unhoused example. Because if in order to get a meal and be housed, if you have to give up your individuality and your humanity, mm-hmm. you know, you're gonna have to make a choice. And it's our system that makes them make that choice.
Yeah, I think there's also that whole, like, you know, people go, oh, can't they just get a job or can't they just do this? Yeah. And it's like, well, if you can't shower and bathe and you don't have clothes for an interview and someone's asking for a resume or an online portfolio and you're like,
yeah, right.
You know, like, this person's not eating. They don't have the ability. So, I mean, I guess just meeting people where they are, figuring out what they mm-hmm. need, asking, it sounds like asking someone, can I help or what can I do to help? That's the best way than just making an assumption and dropping off a bunch of diapers or tomato sauce.
Right. Oh, yeah, exactly. And just, yeah, I mean, it's about losing our own ego and thinking we have all the answers and that we know what's best, because it's not our job to decide for someone else what's best for them.
There's also the assumption that people who are houseless are, you know, all alcoholics or all uh-huh. doing, you know, meth or heroin. But I mean, when I talk to people who are houseless, I mean, it could be a community college professor that lost their job. It could be a family who was, like, you know, one paycheck away from not eating.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's not this sort of
No, and it's
and not it's, it's not that everyone is a schizophrenic criminal who doesn't want to have responsibility. Like, but that's sort of the painted view of people.
Well, that's I mean, especially in this, you know, Oregon's houseless crisis is so complex because there's so many things feeding into how it's come to be. And there are a significant number of folks on the street with mental health issues that a completely dismantled system put into motion years ago. That happened right after I moved here, actually, when they basically closed down the mental health system in this state. But I think one of the things that I feel really fortunate about is having people around me who make me think more deeply about things. And one of those is, it really actually doesn't matter why someone's on the street. They still need to eat. They still need to have some clothes. They still need somewhere to lay down. Right? It doesn't matter if they're schizophrenic. It doesn't matter if they just lost their job 2 months ago and the rent tripled overnight. And I mean, all of those things are very real. But at the end of the day, they're still humans who deserve some level of dignity in how we interact with them. And we don't get to judge why it is they've ended up outside.
You know? Yeah, that's a really good point. I always think about, like, there's someone's child or someone's mother or, you know, like, they're like what you're saying, that not just that they're human, but that this is not their whole history. They have a personality. Like, it's not just like they're not a number, like that's a homeless person or that's a houseless person over there. It's, this is someone who deserves to have that dignity and that respect because they actually do have a story and they have, you know, a place where they're from and they have places they want to go or.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely.
So I wanted to talk to you quickly. I just have one more question and then I have like our five questions we ask everybody. I wanted to talk to you about the mural project. That's going to be coming downtown. What you're able to reveal about it. I know some of it is
It's all open now because we sent out the press release yesterday.
Oh, nice. Okay. I know before it wasn't revealable. So yeah. Can you tell us about the mural that's going to be going up?
Sure. We have been working with a, arts production team who approached us in late 2019 and about a mural, and they approached us to get feedback on who they were including. Someone had told them to come in and get our opinion on what they were doing, basically. And that conversation turned into Pride Northwest totally needs to be involved in this project at some point in some level. And so over the next year, basically, we worked together to identify who should be in the mural and process and all this, just a lot of stuff. And now it's a full-on partnership to make this mural happen. It is Portland's first LGBTQ plus specific mural, believe it or not, going back to talking about Portland's reputation versus reality. And as far as I know, it's the first in Oregon. It's going to be downtown on the building that's right across the street from the old Embers. It's called, now I think it's called the Arts Condo Association building. And it's going to be huge. It's right on Broadway. Work on the mural is set to begin in early June. And the production team's goal is to have it completed by the end of March, maybe early July. Some of that depends on what Oregon weather decides to do. We are not planning a large celebration at the time that it's completed because it's just too soon. We are hoping to be able to do something fairly significant in the fall. But really, the mural is it's very similar to Pride. It's our big piece of visibility, really. We, again, you know, we don't have anything like it, and our community deserves to be celebrated in this way and to be visible in this way. We're the mural itself started out as a queer heroes mural, and then over time in our conversations and working through everything, you know, Pride Northwest is really committed to empowering all of our people. And when you turn, when you call someone a hero, when you start using that term, it tends to other them in some way. The, you know, they're on a pedestal, expectations are different, and the assumption is there's something special about them and not something special about anyone else. So our priority has been to have something that really empowers our community to see themselves up on that wall. And that, you know, well-known people, famous people, people who accomplish things don't really actually have any more courage than anyone else does. And so it's super important to us that, that our people see themselves in this mural. There's a lot of education planned around it, curriculum development. There's a longer term project planned around the mural. The mural is kind of a starting point.
Very cool. Well, I think that's great. I love the murals in the city, and I agree. I think a mural is needed, so we're getting one. So that's very exciting.
Right on. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. So,
very cool. So these are the five questions that I ask everybody. So
the first one is, if Pride Northwest wasn't your job or your focus, what would be your passion project or the thing that you would be doing?
I would be consulting, supporting small and emerging nonprofit organizations, particularly in governance and board development.
Cool. Very much needed. What is something other than your given or chosen family that you know will always bring you joy?
Stevie Nicks.
I love Stevie Nicks.
All just things Stevie.
Just Stevie Nicks or the whole band?
Oh, Stevie. Stevie's the reason I love the band. They're great, but it's all Stevie.
What are you binge watching or reading right now?
Well, we're about 2.5 minutes away from Pride, so I'm not reading anything. And honestly, most of what I'm watching are learning videos around some craft things that my wife and I are working on.
That's fun. Mm-hmm. When the world opens up, let's say, post-pandemic, where would you like to travel to?
Honestly, I'd like to, if my wife's family comes here, we want to go to the coast. And if they don't, we want to go and visit them. I'd also love to go and see my own parents in Texas. I think that's a little further down the road.
Yeah. Where's your wife's family at?
They're in southeast Idaho.
Oh, okay. So not too far.
No, it's a day.
Yeah. If you were to give a TED Talk, which you should or may in the future, what would you want to share? What would your topic be about?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I could talk for days about Pride. I'm not sure if anyone would stay in the room that long. Probably, you know, I'm not sure if I have a clear answer to that. It's a mix of community and LGBTQ plus history and where we've come from and where we're going and what we're facing, probably.
Sounds like a good talk. Mm-hmm. I would stay. And then finally, give some of your shout outs to either local businesses or organizations that you want to say hi to, or you think are doing a good job that we should follow.
Well, that's another one. Holy smokes. Well, I have to say that considering the fact that I don't drink very much and we don't go out a whole lot, I love Deschutes. They as an Oregon company, walk their talk in the community. I mean, I love Poison Waters, Maria Peters Lake, Kimberly Van Patten, Layla, there's Stephen Lane at Under You for Men has been a strong supporter over the years. Robert, yeah, I'm not really sure where to start with that one.
Well, it's a good list. We just do like a wrap up where we're saying everybody else who's amazing.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a big list. I've had a lot of support over the years, and most of the people who are at the top of my list aren't really well-known people. They're activists in the community who have taught me a lot and have allowed me space to learn and supported me in that, you know.
And then how do people find information about you, about Pride, how to get involved? Like, leave us with some information or some call to action.
Sure. Well, it's Pride can definitely use the community support. Pride Northwest has been lucky in that we were not as all of Pride was hit really hard by COVID. There are Pride organizations that won't come back, I promise. We have been lucky that we put in a lot of work for years, building up a little bit of a reserve. But COVID has hit really hard. And so supporting what we're doing, supporting what we want to do is fantastic. The best way to get involved is our website is pridenw.org. That's our organizational website. That's where you'll also find information about the LGBTQ+ mural that's about to be created and unveiled, as well as some other things that we're working on. And that's also where folks can sign up and volunteer and get engaged at that level as well.
Very cool. Well, thank you for being on the podcast. And also thanks for being a friend and a great community member. You inspire me.
Well, the same. You're on that. You're definitely high on that list.
Oh, well, I didn't pay you to say that, but I'll take it. Thank you so much. Well, I look forward. I know you have a bunch of other calls and things, but I look forward to seeing you in person during some of the Pride in person things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Right on. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Have a good rest of your day.
You too.
A very special thank you to Deborah Porta of Pride Northwest. For all things Pride Northwest, be sure to visit pridenw.org. There you'll find information on Portland Pride, programs, community outreach, and more. Once again, that's pridenw.org. We want to give another shout out to our friends at X-Ray FM. You can see all the great things they're doing for our community by visiting xray.fm. And of course, a very big thank you to you for checking out this episode of the podcast. Be sure not to miss any of our upcoming guests by subscribing to the podcast on your favorite streaming service. You can also visit alofyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, custom gear, and if you happen to know anybody that you think would be a great fit for the podcast, click our contact page and let us know. This interview was done via Zoom and edited at Track 11 Music.